It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, we continue our summer music series, Set List. Today we'll feature J.E. Sundy, a singer-songwriter who grew up in the small town of Amory, Wisconsin. First, it's time for a weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup. Oshkosh Corporation made headlines this week when it won a contract from the U.S. military to create armored vehicles for the Army and Marines. Other big stories included Governor Walker drawing attention with comments on foreign policy, and state newspapers also took a look at how municipalities are decriminalizing marijuana possession around the state. We're joined now by Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start in Oshkosh. The Oshkosh Corporation in the Fox Valley area got this big contract from the military to make tactical vehicles. Can you give us some idea of how big a deal this is?
So it's $6.7 billion, and that's to start. So I don't know about you, that to me seems like a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
and we're told that it is a lot of money. So this is the contract for Oshkosh Corp to make what is going to be the replacement to the Humvee. So it's a big giant truck, and it has a ton of power, and it's really strong. The production is going to start in 2016, and they say that it's this sort of phase of the contract goes through 2024 and could be worth up to $30 billion eventually. And this is one of those things when you have such a giant contract like this that it has these ripple effects. So Oshkosh Corp has suppliers that likely get contracts as a result of this, and there's a lot of pretty much a statewide economic effect.
Yeah, so there is the prospect, a lot of people will be hopeful, that this will be a big boost to the economy in that area and to jobs in that area.
For sure. Although the jobs numbers were not clear as of this week, I think that the Oshkosh Corp has a lot of sort of rolling contracts, and so it's not completely clear whether they're going to end up staffing up a lot for these. But over time, it certainly adds to job security for those people. I think it's likely that they're going to have to hire more workers, and it just bolsters that industry there.
And Wisconsin, not necessarily a heavy hitter on the military appropriations scene. This is unusual for our state, except for this corporation and some marine companies as well.
Totally. And one of the companies that that Oshkosh beat out was Lockheed Martin, one of the largest military contractors in the country. So it's seen as a big win for Wisconsin, I guess.
And I guess another shoe that could drop is, as goes the U.S. military, so sometimes go allies. We could see foreign orders for these in the coming years.
Sure enough. And you know, I mean, it's worth saying also, you know, 2024 is a long time from now, there certainly is, between federal budget cutting, it's hard, you know, there certainly is some prospect that military spending could, it's not exactly certain. Then again, this is, Humvees are not the same as really expensive aircraft or aircraft carriers or something. It seems like, as security goes, likely to be reliable.
Meanwhile, the campaign trail, Governor Walker making his big foreign policy speech today after some comments on China earlier in the week. What are people making of the message that presidential candidate Walker is sending on foreign policy?
Sure. Well, I mean, it was in your newscast as well. It was a very hawkish, very aggressive, some would say muscular foreign policy speech on the approach that he would take as president. A lot of a lot of harsh critiques of the Obama administration and handling of especially battle with the Islamic State group ISIS, and also criticism for being willing to negotiate with Iran over nuclear ambitions. So this is in the political context of the presidential race, this represents Walker staking out a pretty right wing position. He's to the right of Jeb Bush, who does not say that he would necessarily completely scuttle the Iran deal. Walker does say he would do that on day one. And also to the right of what's that other guy in the Republican race? I guess Donald Trump.
Oh yeah,
yeah. There's that guy too. And this is a big factor actually, because the effect that Trump has had on the race is to take all the oxygen out of the Republican race. Right. Everything is focused on Trump. So in a way, this is a attempt for the Walker campaign to sort of claim get in the news cycle. cycle and get in the headlines with a big, strong, tough-talking speech. And, you know, it's been covered that way. So.
And governors for president, often a concern is foreign policy. The governor had some trouble on the campaign trail on this. Is this an attempt to tackle that concern head on?
For sure. He was... criticized for saying that, referring to his experience with the protesters against Act 10 and in the recall process, as saying he had said earlier in the campaign that's the sort of approach he would bring to working with Iran or whatever. That's not necessarily a great sounding message. So this is his first major foreign policy address where he tries to outline an overall foreign policy vision. And yeah, he's as governor, that hasn't been on his plate. So it's him introducing his vision on that.
And briefly, closer to home, Robert, the Stevens Point Journal looked at how municipalities are decriminalizing marijuana possession around the state. In a nutshell, what are we seeing going on in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so this is report that's going to run it's up online in Gannett, Wisconsin newspapers, and it's going to run this weekend. And what we did was look at decriminalization. There's sort of this backdoor decriminalization thing happening where we found 9 of the 10 largest cities in the state have gotten it down to a fine rather than any kind of criminal charge. And there's an interesting movement on that front to treat it as something you pay a fine for. And in some cases, not even that. But there's no consistency. It's a total patchwork.
All right, Robert, thank you so much for joining us, as always.
All right, thank you.
We've been talking to Robert Mentzer. He is storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald, joining us to help review the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our new summer music series called Setlist. We invited Wisconsin artists into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances, which will air every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend. Wisconsin native J.E. Sundy now calls Minneapolis home, but he cut his musical teeth in the vibrant Eau Claire music scene that helped launch many great Wisconsin musicians. He recently dropped by the WPR studios to play some songs and talked to Veronica Rickard about how growing up in Amory, Wisconsin has influenced his latest album, Shapes That Kiss the Lips of God.
The black howl of the night is dogging me restless and worn, causing me ceaseless concern and all manner of harm.
J.E. Sundy, thank you so much for coming into the studio and playing for us today.
Oh man, it's my pleasure.
Well, your album is called Shapes That Kiss the Lips of God. Can you tell us a little bit about what the title means?
Yeah, sure. It's a line drawn from one of the tunes that I wrote. It's called Hickory Point Lane in the Fall, and it's where I grew up. And the line refers to birds migrating, shapes that kiss the lips of God.
Is it your phrase?
Yeah, that one, after kind of debating about what to title the record, that one just kept coming back to me, and so I trusted it, and I've enjoyed it.
And you grew up in Amory, Wisconsin.
That's right, yeah.
And I've read that this album is sort of autobiographical for you. Not explicitly so, not totally, but there are strains like that. How do you think about that in terms of how personal it is for you?
Yeah, the songs kind of came out of about 10 years. I played in another band called The Daredevil Christopher Wright, and we were, for about 10 years, doing it very seriously, and in that time, kind of a back catalog of songs started developing that for various reasons just didn't get turned into Daredevil songs. And so every once in a while I'd play things solo, and I generally kind of draw from that catalog of things. And so, and it just so happened, as I kind of was putting together the record, that as I looked at kind of the songs that were becoming the record, it just seemed to kind of chronicle the 10 years interestingly.
Does that make it kind of nostalgic for you, looking back on those 10 years a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it revealed itself in that way, and it was kind of a nostalgic, or it just felt good as a kind of a statement of that time for me, I guess, which was, I don't know, personally and artistically satisfying, I think.
Change. Down, and I go uptown.
that you said that for some of these songs, you had to just not shy away from the shadow of your influences, like Nina Simone, Leonard Cohen. Were you reluctant at first to go that way and to reflect on this other music that you loved?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's I think for anybody who's making stuff, especially in the arts, there's that kind of tension between, you know, people that you admire and are certainly drawing from in terms of people who influence you, but then also this draw or desire to create something original. And so the tension is there always. And we would, with the guys in Daredevil, we would have pretty long discussions about the place of influences, you know, and whether you should purely be striving for originality or whether you should honor kind of these, mm-hmm. you know, the things that are inspiring you in a more direct way. And after a while, I just got so exhausted by the responsibility of trying to be original that I was putting on myself. It just didn't, like, the notion as I went to write a song that, like, okay, I need to write something that is original, just didn't seem to be energizing me at all. It felt more crippling than, like, freeing, you know? And so at some point, I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to try to follow things that feel intuitive and feel good. And if they happen to be derivative or they happen to sound like Paul Simon or Leonard Cohen, I'm just going to be okay with that, you know? And the best thing is just to try to create something you're excited about and then trust as best as you can that that's going to be something somebody else is going to get excited about too. And that's about as good as you can do. I've just kind of given up on the whole, like, fear of derivativeness at this point, mostly. Sometimes. Often.
Some of the time.
I'm going to disappoint you someday. I'm gonna disappoint you someday. I try and say the right things and I'll do my best, but you know it can't last.
I want to ask a little bit about your voice, because it seems as though you've got an incredible range. Was that always natural for you?
No. I mean, I've been singing in, you know, my whole life, and have been interested in it for as long as I can remember. But then I went to college at UW-Eau Claire and studied voice. And so I learned the, you know, Western classical tradition. And throughout my time learning, kind of, you know, singing in choirs and singing in chamber groups and singing solo in this Western classical style, I was playing in bars and venues and playing rock and roll and folk stuff. And that was the stuff I was more passionate about. And so I kind of had a foot out the door a little bit. So, I mean, there are people who really struggle with being schooled in music in terms of they feel really confined by the structures or the rules of that particular style of music. But I just never really, maybe because I always had these two kind of parallel musical worlds going on, I never felt bound by the rules of classical music. It was more like, this is a beautiful way to understand your body and your voice, how it's connected, and you can use this stuff in any kind of music.
Don't die. That I could love you if you let me. I can't bear to think that you'd ever forget me, so I will give it a try.
And along the way, you found yourself to the Eau Claire music scene. It sounds like you were there when a lot was going on. Yeah. You were part of this circle with S. Carey and Bon Iver, Justin Vernon. Mm-hmm. What was it like being part of that scene then, and how did it influence you?
Yeah, you know, like you said, I grew up in Amory, Wisconsin, which is a little town, and there isn't really a tradition of kids making bands for as long as I can remember. And so I thought, when I go to college, I'm going to start a band. College is where you make bands. And so it was interesting. I got to the orientation week my freshman year in Eau Claire. One of the bands they had on campus was D'Armond Edison, which was the Megaphone guys and Justin Vernon's former band. And I saw them, like, literally the first week I was in Eau Claire, and it was just like I was seeing a band that I was totally blown away by. Yeah, from then on, I mean, it was just like there's just this strong tradition of these people, like between the kids who grew up in the Chippewa Valley and then also people coming in for a university, that have just mixed to create this long tradition of people making really great bands and a diversity of bands between the jazz programs and the folk and rock scenes and stuff like that. And it was just like this total soup of people creating, but also very small enough that you could, if you wanted to, you could be a part of it, you know? Field Report and Chris Porterfield or, you know, or S. Carey or some of these guys, and I pause and like look back and realize that like there's an amazing amount of people that I met in that time that are still creating better and better art 10 years later, you know, and that, so I feel like it really was a pretty unique time and place in terms of all these things coming together that I'm really grateful for. You know?
And was it empowering when Bon Iver took off that you guys were all there and you could say, wow, yeah, this guy can make it. Everybody's got a shot.
Totally. I mean, initially it was like total drunk by proximity kind of thing. Everybody's like, we're all going to be on these big record labels. And it's just, it's from here on out, we're all enormous successes. No, I mean, but it was like, it was just unbelievable to see somebody you knew and making this amazing record and suddenly the world just totally flipping out about it. But like I say, I mean, I've seen the course of then these other acts who are still doing it and making great music and touring and are connected with strong labels now. And I just know the work that they've put in. And so I think it gave me the perspective that most of that success is grounded on an enormous amount of work, which is very much anybody can do an enormous amount of work if you want to.
That's a question you've thought a lot about over the years, what it means to make art and song and really go full in,
yeah,
all in on that and really pursue your passion for music. But on the other hand, there's also this set of societal expectations,
totally,
about getting a job, yeah, settling down, not touring.
Mm-hmm.
Have you faced that and what society you've come out on?
Yeah, you know, I turned 31 this year and, you know, for basically my entire adult life, I've been trying to play music. And I wrestled a lot with this notion of, well, do I find a career? And if so, what would that be? I mean, I have no other... The abiding passion of my life is music, you know, and if I'm an expert at anything, it's that. I've spent more time doing that than anything else. And because of that, I haven't cultivated an enormously impressive resume to present to some, you know, institution that I'm really excited about. And so it was a time of really difficult transition. But after... wrestling with that for a while, I kind of came to this piece where I recognized, you know what, I just believe in passion. I believe that our society should at the very least honor our passions much more than we do. That doesn't mean it's going to be your job necessarily, but I feel like too quickly we dismiss our dreams and the things that we love to do. And so for me, I realized, you know what, I will get a job cleaning houses part-time and then I will play music. And I think, at least at this point, I think I could clean houses for my whole life if it allows me to make music. That may change, but yeah, I've come to a lot of peace about that at this moment. Talk to me in a week and we'll see, but that's where I'm at. So,
Jay, thank you so much for coming to the studio and talking today and playing. Appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
That was singer-songwriter J.E. Sundy. You can find out more about him at jesundy.com. The Setlist Summer Music Series airs here on Central Time every Friday at 4:15 through early September. To learn more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to wpr.org/setlist. Next Friday on this summer's final episode of Setlist, we'll feature the Madison post-rock band El Valiente. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. During a recent gathering in New Hampshire, Governor Walker said he would support term limits for Congress and the federal judiciary. While a number of states currently have their own laws that set term limits, the only federal law applies to the big one, the President of the United States. Term limits are generally a popular topic during elections. So far, presidential candidates Jeb Bush, Bobby Jindal, and Ben Carson have all supported term limits for elected officials. We're joined now by Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College, to discuss the arguments for and against term limits. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
So as a jumping off point, Governor Walker said he'd support 12-year term limits for Congress and the federal judiciary. So for a senator, that's two terms. A person in the House, six two-year terms. Is this the sort of thing we've heard proposed, talked about before?
We have. I mean, the movement for term limits in the United States, at least sort of in the contemporary political debate, started in the late 80s and early 90s. There was a big push, especially at the state level, but it's also occurred at the federal level as well. You've heard lots of talk about this, especially among candidates themselves who've made promises to reform the system or to self-impose term limits on themselves so that they wouldn't run after a designated amount of time. You know, it's really kind of waned, though, in probably the last 10 years or so. It doesn't really have the same kind of traction that had in the past. And I think that's in part because at the state level, most of the states where you would have seen it, they've already passed it. And at the federal level, it's rather hard to accomplish. So it's really hard to keep the momentum going.
Right. And if a state passes it, people in Congress don't care, right? Because federal law applies to them, not the state law.
Exactly. It's a state issue. It's a state constitutional or statutory issue, and so there's no effect that it can have on anybody who's running for elective office at the federal level.
You've mentioned self-imposed term limits. I think I remember that in the big Gingrich year in Congress, a lot of incoming freshman Republicans in the House made term limit vows, and many of them held to them.
Many of them did, but many of them didn't. I mean, part of it was Gingrich's contract with America that listeners might recall, where they offered to make some votes, at least in the House of Representatives, regarding a number of important policy issues, or at least ones they thought the public thought were important. And one of them had to do with term limits. Now, of course, they couldn't change it statutorily. It was probably going to have to be through a constitutional amendment. So that left individual members willingly giving up their seat. But, you know, there's this aphorism we often talk about in politics, which is, where you sit is where you stand. That is, your stand on an issue is going to change depending on what seat you inhabit. And, you know, term limits are great when you're out of office, but once you get elected, they stop looking so great anymore because it means you have to leave. So a lot of people had a change of heart once they got elected to Congress.
Now, you mentioned that a number of states have implemented their own term limits. What are some of the ways that they work? What varies? What's in common in those different states?
Well, what varies most of all are differences between whether or not you have what's called a consecutive or a lifetime ban on the term limit. So in some states, and it's fewer in the United States, it's only about six states, they have a lifetime ban, which is when you hit the maximum number of years that you can serve, you're done. And so you can never run for elective office, at least in the state legislature, again. And so you can use those number of years to serve both in the state house, in the state senate, or in just one chamber. It doesn't matter. But once you hit the number, you're done. In others, the clock is running while you're in office. And if you hit the max, you can't run for reelection. But in many of those states, after a certain designated amount of time, you can start up the clock all over again. So, and in some states, it's as few as 2 years. So you only get a two-year break, and then you can be right back in the thick of things.
Have we ever seen states, if you know this, impose term limits and then take them back, change their minds down the road?
Yeah, well, we've seen that in Idaho, and we've seen that in Utah. The legislature in both of those states repealed their term limits. And in four other states, the state Supreme Court has said the manner in which they imposed the term limits was unconstitutional under their state constitution. And so they could have gone back and reinstituted them following that the rules prescribed by the Constitution and by the court, but those states didn't go and do it. So we've seen six states who passed them, and then they couldn't go into effect or they were repealed.
We're talking to political scientist Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College about the idea of term limits. It's come up on the presidential trail, Governor Walker and some other Republican candidates saying, hey, we should have term limits for Congress and some federal judges as well. You can join in with your thoughts of for or against or your questions at 800-642-1234. Charlie, let's get into some of the pro-con. When people are arguing for term limits, what are some of the main things they're pointing to that it would fix?
So I think one of the biggest ones is the idea that we're supposed to have citizen legislators in the United States. And when you have term limits, it means that an individual can't get entrenched in a position and basically hold it for their entire life and possibly, in some cases, hand it off to a relative, a spouse or a child or something like that. And so the idea is that we get rid of these entrenched individuals and we can get sort of a new breed of citizen legislatures in. So there's this issue of sort of compositional effects that it's going to have. The composition of the institution will change. And sort of as a corollary, the idea is this might give an opportunity for other groups or people from other groups to get a chance to actually win. So maybe more racial or ethnic minorities, more women, and hopefully that'll have an effect on the way in which legislation gets passed.
Yeah, and in recent years or recent decades, really, there's a pretty substantial incumbent advantage for Congress, isn't there, in elections?
Yeah, I mean, for those who choose to run again, it's in the 90s, sometimes in the high 90 percentile of winning re-election. So, you know, you gain all these advantages when you win and you continue to win. There's a predictability in the way you behave, which means that lobbyists are more interested in supporting you. The public has name recognition with you, and so your candidacy is really supported. Add into that the idea of helping to control your district and its shape, the idea of gerrymandering, and you might have a real advantage in running for re-election.
And then another argument in favor of this is the concern that if you are too long in the nation's capital of Washington, you establish an establishment mindset, a Washington mindset, maybe lose touch with your home district. Is there any evidence that there's something to that argument in as much as we can measure it?
Well, here's the funny thing is that the evidence on term limits that we have regarding that issue actually shows the exact opposite, that in states or in states and in other jurisdictions that have term limits, the individuals tend to become less focused on their constituents because they know their constituents won't matter after a time. That sort of the pork barrel effect, the writing of legislation to bring dollars back to your district, is actually stronger where you have to run for re-election to retain your seat long into the future. So there's a behavioral change. People basically say, nah, I don't really care about my constituents' concerns anymore, and I will think sort of more personally about what I think what policy is important, and I'll think more on a statewide basis than merely on a district-wide basis. So it actually has the reverse effect, at least some of the better research we have, it has a reverse effect on the way in which we expect them to behave.
Another concern people have pointed to is the idea that if you've got this constantly changing cast of characters in a legislature without that institutional memory, without the experience, they're more dependent on maybe their party machinery, their staff, and lobbyists to do a lot of the work that a long-term congressperson might have the wherewithal to do themselves. Is there something to that?
There is something to say. Some of the research that's been done by some legislative scholars has indicated that you know, you get these new individuals in office and they don't know the ropes, and then you have a whole group of people who don't know the ropes. You know, the joke is they can't even find the bathroom on their own, let alone understanding how to write legislation. And so they have to lean on a lot of experts in the field. And so, in essence, you know, the power doesn't disappear. It just gets shifted to somebody else. And in the legislative bodies, that really falls to staff, because the staff isn't elected. They're professionalized. And they often just get hired by new elected officials to office. So they kind of control the pace and the content of the legislative agenda, because they kind of know it's important. They know what should be on top of the agenda. And the newbies in the legislature just kind of follow along. And I don't want to sort of characterize them as sheep, but when you don't know what you're doing, when you're such a neophyte in the institution, you have to rely on those with expertise, and those tend to be staff. And, of course, the staff can get co-opted by lobbyists, and the lobbyists can exert pressure even on these new members. So they have an effect as well.
Do we, on a potential upside of term limits, given that there's this churn, this required turnover, do we see different kinds of people, maybe from different backgrounds, taking the plunge into politics?
You know, some of the research has suggested that you do see more women getting an opportunity, but beyond that, the compositional effects are really, really minor. We don't see a lot of differentiation among the legislature once it adopts term limits. So it's not as though there's this sea change in the type of individuals who's running. And part of that is explained by something else political scientists have noted, which is that politicians can be very, very strategic. And so they'll run for a new office, or they'll take a chance to run for a new office if there's an opportunity to do so. And so in states with term limits, when people leave because their terms are up, what happens is individuals from other elected offices lower down the food chain of politics decide to slide up. And so you don't have citizen legislators jumping in. You have people who are very interested in politics, have been engaged in politics for a long time, and they just kind of shift into a new position and move up the ladder of power.
We're talking to political scientist Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College about the arguments for and against term limits. It's come up on the presidential campaign trail with Governor Scott Walker, some other candidates saying, hey, Congress needs term limits. We'd support that, they say. You can join the conversation with your thoughts. Do you support term limits for members of Congress, maybe for federal judges? What would the term limits be? What should they be? What do you think are the arguments for or against term limits? Once upon a time, this was a hot button issue. Is it still? Do you think it would help? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion now on term limits for Congress and federal judges, and we want to hear from you. Do you think federally elected officials should have term limits? Talking mostly Congress here, why or why not? And if you want term limits in Congress, how long should they be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Charlie Jacobs stays with us, professor of political science at St. Norbert College. We'll go to our callers now, starting with Eric on the line in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. You know, I hear this debate come up every so often, and I think most of the folks that are concerned with term limits are concerned with the political corruption in our current Congress, you know, the K Street to Wall Street to Congress sort of revolving door. And I don't know that term limits necessarily solve that problem. Something that might be more effective would be drawing smaller congressional districts so that folks are actually closer to a congressperson instead of having roughly 500,000. We could do something closer to the constitutional 30,000 limit. That's the minimum. And that's what we stayed at for a long time until basically we stopped increasing the size of Congress. You know, mostly that goes back to one of the arguments in the Federalist about, you know, a really large body being dysfunctional. But now as we have, you know, technology like GitHub for software developers, where literally thousands of people will work collaboratively, you know, through, you know, version control on, you know, creating a flawless software program. Certainly we can do the same with our laws.
Interesting, Eric. So, thanks a lot for the call. So, Charlie, term limits, no, but maybe congressional people could represent people if they represented fewer people.
Yeah, I mean, Eric makes a very good point there. I'll just correct him only to sort of reinforce his point. I mean, our congressional districts now are getting to 750,000 people apiece. So it's even larger than he speculated. Of course, you run into the same difficulty with that suggestion as you do with term limits, which is what legislator is going to diminish his or her own power by adding others to the body? And Eric's suggestion, again, which has been bandied about for a long time, would add possibly more than 1,000 people to the House of Representatives. And if it's like herding kittens now in that institution, it's going to be 10 times worse when you have that many individuals. Now, of course, the Federalists were very concerned, as were the founders, with making sure that legislators were close to those who were governing them. It's sort of the peeping Tom approach. They can look in the window very closely at what their legislator is doing. And so it's a valid argument to make. It's just whether or not, even with technology, you could manage a body that size.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call and the suggestion. We'll go now to Doug on the line in Waukesha. Doug, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think anybody that would assume that we couldn't get a better pool of politicians in our ranks by term limits is crazy. We need a bigger pool of responsible people. The people that have been in Congress, they feel that they're entitled to way too much, and the power they wield is crazy.
Doug, thanks a lot for the call. So a sense of entitlement if you get to spend too long in Congress, Charlie.
I mean, there is that comfort zone. You raised it before about the incumbency level, and that individuals, unless you're in your first or second term in Congress, you're almost bulletproof. I mean, they used to call Reagan the, you know, Teflon president, and there's a certain sense of that with members of Congress, too, that they can do almost anything and not face any repercussions. And, of course, I think there's twofold issues here, and I think both Doug and Eric seem to be rubbing up against them, which is, you know, the sense of gerrymandering, which is entrenching them in these very large districts, and people just, they don't have a choice. And so they're comfortable with a particular individual, and they reelect them. And then, of course, the corruption that Doug is pointing to, and I expect he's suggesting in part the money that flows into these campaigns and the kind of support they get from particular moneyed interests. And so it's very difficult to wrest these people out of their positions or put on a credible campaign if you really are expecting to be a citizen legislator, somebody who has a day-to-day job but thinks they have a civic responsibility to serve. It's hard to face someone who's got war chests, you know, in excess of $5, $6, $7 million to run for, say, U.S. Senate. And in some cases, it's getting that large for particular seats for the House of Representatives in places like California.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about the idea of term limits, especially for Congress, with Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234 with Willie in Madison. Willie, hi.
Hi. Hey, I have an idea of... I would just want your guests to speculate if this could clean the system up. The funding right now is a real problem for us with established legislators and all of that. What if we could, if it became possible, have an entirely public-funded system, the vehicle of which, of course, would have to probably be public radio. Its size would have to be expanded in many parts of the country so that the entire campaign media stuff would take place largely on public radio because everybody would get it who was running and met a certain criterion. Then you could get rid of the fact that extremely rich people have undue influence and that people without any money but great ideas don't have a chance. Do you understand what I'm suggesting?
Willie, thanks a lot for the call. I think so. So mandating more media time for candidates on a shared platform with less of the unshared platforms, Charlie, I think there's something similar to that in Israel, where all parties are guaranteed a certain amount of time in the media. What do you think that would do to change the landscape, Charlie?
Well, to change that landscape, we're looking at another constitutional amendment, because most of the decisions by the United States Supreme Court dealing with issues of electioneering always run up against the First Amendment and free speech issues. Going back to Buckley v. Valeo, And the idea that, and this is a gross simplification, but basically money equals speech. So we can do some limits. I mean, the court has consistently said you don't want the system to be perceived as corrupt, and so certain limits can be in place. But, of course, that only controls the candidates themselves. Then you've got third-party actors, and they can spend in an unlimited way. So you'd have to have some sort of constitutional amendment that created either some sort of maximum you could spend with a cost of living adjustment that's available, something to that effect. You could limit the time in which somebody could run for election, so the elections wouldn't start till, say, September 1st of an election year. Those things could be put into place, but again, we're talking about that big hurdle of amending the Constitution to achieve it.
There have been public finance laws in states where it says, hey, we'll pay for your campaign up to a certain amount if you agree to abide by extra restrictions. That doesn't seem to be on the grow in the United States, though.
It isn't, because the amount that you get is often less than you could possibly rake in by just going and raising your own dollars. And so, you know, it's kind of a fool's choice in that regard. And you have to hope that the other person running also agrees to take the public funds and limits that kind of electioneering communication. So it's kind of seen as imprudent on the part of an individual who's running for office. You're just giving up dollars by taking the public dollars. I think it's worked a little bit better on the judicial side, because there are other restrictions about who you can ask and who can do the asking for money, and so it's often been difficult to raise the money. But for legislative races, for executive races, the money just pours in, and so limiting yourself is kind of foolish.
Back to our callers with David in Janesville. David, hi.
Hi. As I was listening to your program, I thought of what might be a way of limiting it. And basically that is that now legislators who are in for a long time draw a retirement. Their insurance is paid. They receive a lot of benefits in that way. I think that legislators should be serving because they want to, not because of their future, and staying longer encourages them to receive a retirement. Their insurance is paid for. I think what should happen is that it goes away.
Gotcha, so. David. So, Charlie, cut the benefits for people in Congress to escort them out the door a little faster.
And you know, David's suggestion has been applied for years in several states that limit what you get paid. I mean, they, in essence, force you to be a legislator as a second job, an avocation rather than a vocation. But, of course, the possible problem with that is if you really aren't remunerated very well at all, that could jack up the incidence of corruption, because now you're more willing to be on the take while you're in office. And so there is that worry that there has to be a proper balance. And, of course, we could come up with that proper balance enough to entice good people to fill the positions and do a good job while there, while reducing the incidence of corruption. And so it's this, you know, it's that Goldilocks problem. You got to hit it just right, or you're going to have some big problems in your legislative branch.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
That's Charlie Jacobs. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College, with us to help break down the pros and cons of federal term limits for members of Congress. The idea floated lately on the presidential campaign trail. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.